What I'd like to do with you tonight is to share some thoughts that I've actually written down, and then when I've had a chance to do that, I'd like to invite your participation, your questions, comments, anything you'd like to add. This is a kind of a summary of some of the thinking that I've been doing in recent months. And so I'd like to just share some of these ideas with you. The title of the session tonight is Wilderness and the Search for the Soul of the Modern Person. Now today, on television and in newspapers and periodicals and from all kinds of sources, we read, we see, we hear a great deal about the ecological crisis in our world, that our world faces. And if you come and spend any time at all at Holden Village, you can't avoid getting involved in some discussion or another around this issue, because this is a major thrust of ours here in the village. We think that, along with many others, that this is the decade we as a human community have got to make some serious decisions about this crisis, or some of the decisions that will be made for us will be irreversible and not kindly. In our issue of the Holden Village News, the last one, I had a number of quotations, and I'm sure many of you read them. One from the World Council of Churches: God's earth faces a crisis. Without serious immediate attention, the future of life as we know it is grim. Or another one by the Director General of the United Nations Environmental Program: we face, by the turn of the century, an environmental catastrophe as complete, as irreversible as any nuclear holocaust. Now, what is the root of this problem? And what are some of the steps each of us personally can take to deal with this problem? And tonight I'd like to approach this problem from a theological and a psychological perspective. And this, I want to say, this is in no way in contradistinction to our need to be in touch with this issue scientifically, or our need to be in touch with this issue politically or economically. But what I'd like to add to our thinking is this other perspective, the theological and psychological perspective, the spiritual dimension. I want to suggest to you that the root of the problem is that human beings are estranged, that means separated, from their soul and from their own inner nature. And that is the root. I want to suggest tonight that is the root of our environmental crisis today. Secondly, I want to suggest to you tonight that one of the routes back to connectedness with our own nature, with our own soul, is through nature itself, or through the wilderness. God speaks to us there about what is needful in here. I once asked the analyst that I was working with at the time in Los Angeles in the early 70s. We got to talking about my own personal fascination with nature, and he said to me a line that I will never forget as long as I live. And he said, "Scott," he said, "obviously your fascination with nature is because you are trying to get in touch with your own nature." And of course I had to think about that for quite a while, and I'm still thinking about that. In fact, that's where this paper comes from. So first of all, let's deal with the issue of being estranged from our soul. Now, soul is a word that describes, could be described, defined in a variety of ways, but tonight I'd like to simply define it as the essence of what you are, the essence of what you are, or what I am. It is another word for our nature. Soul is another word for our nature. Now, we all live firmly in a scientific era of human history, the scientific era of human history. Scientific discoveries and their technological applications have made life possible for millions more people on Earth than perhaps could be sustained otherwise, and life much more enjoyable for a significant percentage of those millions. By using the laws of nature, we have become fascinated, particularly in the Western world, by what we could create and then ultimately what we could consume. In our Western world, we have defined our success, in fact, in terms of our ability to control and manipulate and consume our outer environment. Our society pays us, rewards us for that kind of activity. That's the kind of society we live in. The more we can manipulate, the more power we can garner. Our society rewards us by allowing us or providing for us in such a way that the more we can consume. And so we have what I like to say, we have become intoxicated with progress. And that has led to, from a psychological perspective, that has led to a lopsided extroversion on everyone's part. Meaning our energies, our attention, our life has been focused outward on what's going on around us and how we can shape that and control that and manipulate that and work within that and be rewarded by that. We're constantly depending on things outside of us to entertain us and shape us and define us and educate us and so forth. That's what I would call a lopsided extroversion in our way of dealing with life today. And the price has been that we have forgotten about the soul, our own soul. In fact, our own soul gets projected outward onto other things. If you live and work within a corporation, and the tendency is, and I had many conversations with corporate executives, particularly when we lived in Norway and had a congregation full of corporate executives, and we talked together. They talked with me, and I with them, and they had as much or more insight into this as I did, about how they had projected their own soul into the corporation, and then they had fulfilled the needs of the corporation, and the corporation had rewarded them, and therefore they were successful within that medium. Now, that's, ministers do the same thing. Ministers project their own spirituality onto the institution, and then busy themselves serving the institution rather than serving their own soul, and get all confused with how successful the institution is versus what's going on with them spiritually, or defining the congregation in light of what's going on in terms of the number of bodies and bricks and mortar and budgets and buildings and so forth, all the bees. Instead of looking at it in terms of what's going on with individuals. Or we can do that with any role in society. Super mom. Define ourselves in terms of our our role and our energy and our success with what's happening out there. Our soul gets projected on. We, as parents, we can project our soul onto our children and make hobbies of them and spend our time trying to manipulate them to be how we think they ought to be. So there are many things that can carry our soul. Now, thus modern human beings have become estranged from their souls by projecting them into the outer world. And this excessive interference then with what's going on outside of us creates disorder in our own inner nature. We create, in contemporary language, a dysfunction, disorder in our own inner nature, because the two are ultimately connected. What goes on outside is intimately connected with what's going on inside, and what's going on inside is intimately connected with what's going on outside. The macrocosm and the microcosm can never be separated. And so, because of this lopsided extroversion, that creates disorder inwardly, and our disorder inwardly then in turn destroys creation outwardly. It sounds paradoxical, but if you can follow. Because our inner nature is in disarray, it's creating havoc in outer nature today. And the reason why our inner order is in disarray is because we're looking so much outwardly for our sense of meaning and direction and our definitions of who we are and success and so on and so forth. We try to state this principle again. The more we have become fascinated with manipulating our outer world in the name of progress, the more we have become estranged from our inner world. And the more we are estranged from our inner world, the more destructive we become to all of creation. Therefore, the human community needs to stop now. We need to stop. And we need to get in touch again with our soul, the soul, with our own inner nature. Or we are going to destroy the world, our outer nature. And what I want to suggest to you tonight is that one of the main ways, not the only way, but one of the main ways in which we get in touch again with our own inner nature, and one of the ways God speaks to us about that necessity, is through nature, through the wilderness, by listening to God in the wilderness. Let me just read to you a quote from a book entitled A Testament to the Wilderness. It's a collection of essays. And this is a particular one is by a Jungian analyst in San Francisco. His name is Meyer, M-E-I-E-R. With our knowledge of the laws of nature, we brought about its domination to the point of constructing A-bombs, and we became destructive to nature in many ways. The dangerous aspects of nature that kept our forebears watchful and humble have now almost disappeared outside because we have gained such control over them. But what has happened is they have turned inward. So the whole of Western society rapidly approaches the physical and mental cracking point from inner dangers. This is no joking matter, for should the outer wilderness disappear altogether, then it would inevitably resurrect powerfully from within, and it would be immediately projected. Enemies would be created, and its terrifying aspects would take revenge for our neglect, our lack of reverence, our ruthless interference with that beautiful order of things. And what of the self-regulation of nature when she is no longer left, when she is no longer left to herself, meaning we have intervened so drastically, when she is excessively interfered with and too badly wounded to be able to recover? The repercussions of this sacrilege in the psyche of the single human being are unpredictable. But one thing is certain, we are in great danger of losing our humanity as a result of this unrelenting process of destruction outwardly. If therefore you equally relentlessly make attempts at preserving the wilderness, you are not only doing something idealistic or ideological, but rather something substantial for the health of people globally. All of this is to say that we must learn to respect the balance between the within and the without, between inner space and outer space, between microcosm and macrocosm. The wilderness within really goes wild, you see, when we damage the wilderness without. And when the wilderness within goes wild, of course, then we get things like consumerism, Nazism, fascisms of all types, racism, sexisms, etc. All the things that destroy and oppress. Now, if we're going to take seriously the recovery of our soul, our own inner nature, which is what I believe what God desires, and what Jesus tried to work at in so many different ways in the people that he met and dealt with, then one of the ways to begin to work at that is to listen to what God is saying to us in the wilderness. You see, God is in the wilderness as well as in human beings. God is in the wilderness as well as in human beings. God is in all of creation. Getting out into nature and by bringing our own consciousness along so that we are aware of what is going on brings us in closer touch with our own God-given nature. And the result can be an opening up of the meaning and purpose of life for us in a whole new way. A whole new focus can emerge for us. One definition of what religious experience is, I mean, there are many different definitions, but a simple definition is that when one has a religious experience, one sees things differently. And because one sees things differently, one changes. One gets changed inside when one sees something differently. Now, sitting in the wilderness, people come to see things differently. Suddenly, they see nature differently, and this means they have begun to see their own nature differently. They have begun to recover their own soul. Gerald May, the psychiatrist, calls these experiences that we all have had unitive experiences, meaning something gets united again within us, the outer and the inner. I would call them holy moments. Let me just share with you a couple of holy moments. The first one is in holy moments in the wilderness. The first one is from Thomas Merton, and it comes from the Seven-Story Mountain, written in 1948. He writes, "How sweet it is out in the fields at the end of a long summer afternoon. The sun is no longer raging at you, and the woods are beginning to throw long blue shadows over the stubble fields where the golden shocks are standing. The sky is cool and you can see the pale half-moon smiling over the monastery in the distance. Perhaps a clean smell of pine comes down to you out of the woods on the breeze and mingles with the richness of the fields and of the harvest. And when the undermaster claps his hands for the end of the work, and you drop your arms and take off your hat to wipe the sweat out of your eyes, in the stillness you realize how the whole valley is alive with the singing of crickets, a constant universal treble going up to God out of the fields, rising like the incense of an evening prayer to the pure sky. He's describing, of course, a very kind of profound, I think, mystical experience that he had in that moment. Or let me read you Fritjof Capra, who wrote the Aquarian, did he write the Aquarian Conspiracy? The Tao of Physics is another one of his books. 5 years ago, he's a physicist. 5 years ago, I had a beautiful experience which set me on a road that has led me to the writing of this book. I was sitting by the ocean. I love to sit by the ocean. How many of you like to sit by the ocean? One late summer afternoon, watching the waves rolling in and feeling the rhythm of my breathing, when I suddenly became aware of my whole environment as being engaged in a gigantic cosmic dance. Being a physicist, I knew that the sand, rocks, water, and air around me were made of vibrating molecules and atoms, and that these consisted of particles which interacted with one another by creating and destroying other particles. I knew also that the Earth's atmosphere was continually bombarded by showers of cosmic rays, particles of high energy, undergoing multiple collisions as they penetrated the air. All this was familiar to me from my research in high energy physics, but until that moment I had only experienced it through graphs, diagrams, and mathematical theories. As I sat on the beach, my former experiences came to life. I saw cascades of energy coming down from outer space, in which particles were created and destroyed in rhythmic pulses. I saw the atoms of the elements and those of my body participating in this cosmic dance of energy. I felt its rhythm, I heard its sound, and at that moment I knew that this was the dance, the Lord of the dancers. Now, many authors have described such experiences with great passion and clarity, to the point that one can almost feel what they are experiencing. For 2 years, I was a canoe guide in the North Woods of Minnesota at a place called Wilderness Canoe Base. Some of you have been there. Some of you have worked there. Some of you will go there again. It's a beautiful place. And one of the authors that I became fascinated with is a fellow from northern Minnesota called Sigrid Olson. And I think I read everything he wrote two or three times in those days. I haven't read everything he's written since then, but still today I can walk with him step by step, listening to every sound and see in my own mind every sight. His writing leads me into my own holy moments out of his experience. One of his great lines talks about what was such a holy moment for him, and let me read you this description. I vividly remember the first time I heard the haunting music. Anybody have an idea what it might be? Right. right, that's it. I used to even be able to imitate it, but I won't try. I'll embarrass myself. It was on the shore of Lake Michigan at the end of a broken pier where a translucent pool shone among the rocks. Seagulls wheeled and cried above me. Waves crashed against the pier, and I was alone in a wild and lovely place. Part of the wind and the water and all the sounds, colors, and feelings of the natural world I had found. That day, I entered into a life of indescribable beauty and delight. He continues, in this wilderness, I saw more clearly those values and influences which have molded the human race over the long centuries. I knew, too, there are moments of insight when ancient truths stand out more vividly and one senses again his or her relationship to the earth and all of life. Such times are worth waiting for, and when they come in some unheralded instant of knowing, are the purest gold. Well, let me just read you one final line. My grandmother was a writer. She lived for over 30 years in Kenya, Africa. And when she left Kenya, she wrote these words. Quote, I felt the train slowly carrying us away, and I was conscious as never before of Kenya's lure tugging at my heartstrings. Africa, with her extremes and unpredictable behavior, held me close. Kenya's lure will forever remain. It lies partly in her snow-clad mountain peaks, and in her crystal lakes nestled in the picturesque settings where brilliant flamingo and teeming herds of magnificent wild animals wander peacefully. Now, when I read Sigrid Olson in my grandmother's journal, I feel like I am there with them in the wilderness. They savored creation, and of course they also had the gift of being able to write about it. And I think if we're going to experience God and creation, then we too have to learn how to savor it. And when we do, holy moments will continue to surprise us. And issues that are before us in our own unconscious that God is wanting us to look at will suddenly emerge in front of us. And we will see more clearly in a whole new way. And that then sets the stage also, you see, for us, for a whole new partnership with creation. Matthew Fox writes, if we savored more, we would communicate more deeply, relate more fully, compete less regularly, and celebrate more authentically. We would be relating more deeply to ourselves, to creation and all its blessedness, to history, past and future, to the now, and to God. That comes from his book, Original Blessing, which is a wonderful, I would say, kind of must reading for all of us. What I am talking about is not unlike the experience, in a sense, of falling in love. We need to fall in love with creation. And out of that falling in love, one develops what the Jewish theologian Martin Buber calls an I-thou relationship. Falling in love leads us beyond what Buber would call an I-it relationship, where we're just interested in what we're relating to in terms of what it can do for us. But an I-thou relationship is what we can do for each other. And it is in what Buber calls an I-thou relationship that he says we glimpse the eternal, or we glimpse God. You see, God is not just involved with people, but with all of creation. The Word of God expresses itself not just in the words of the Bible, not just God's covenants with human beings, but in all of creation. As Genesis 1 says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Meister Eckhart, the 15th, 16th century German mystic, wrote, every creature is a word of God and is a book about God. Or Hildegard of Bingen, The Word is living, being, spirit, all verdant greening, all creativity. This Word manifests itself in every creature. Or the more recent German theologian, von Rath, writes, creation not only exists, it also discharges truth. Wisdom requires a surrender, verging on the mystical, of a person to the glory of existence. Or the Roman Catholic priest Thomas Berry, who's written this most important book called The Dream of the Earth, writes, the universe is the primary revelation of the divine, the primary scripture, the primary locus of the divine-human communion. Okay, that's all the words I have written down. And what I'd like to do for a few moments is just discuss informally with you any of these concepts. So feel free to ask any questions, or if you'd like to add anything I've said, that would be good as well. So what thoughts came to you as I was rambling on here?
Well, I'll tell you, Scott, that's why I came up here, was to reconnect with the wilderness. When I got out of high school, I spent a lot of time just laying around on my back, staring up through the trees, and trying to feel the earth beneath me and the life in the trees above me. And I have felt that for a number of years now. And I can start feeling it after.
Does this whole concept of how the inner and the outer are connected, is that all Greek? Or did I make any sense? Or is that just Scott Hassford rambling around in his own little world? Or did you understand what I was saying? Do you agree with what I was saying? Sometimes I don't always have as good of illustrations for it as I'd like to. How those two. Psychologist Carl Jung once said, it doesn't matter whether you look in or you look out, you see the same thing. That's also a phrase that has intrigued me over the years. The same principles are at work.
One thing I was thinking about, you know, when you were talking about getting in touch with your own soul from nature, I realize how nourishing nature is to me. I feel nourished when I'm out in nature.
It's amazing, you can be wounded and you can go for a walk in the mountains, and what a therapeutic event that will be for you, right? We were talking earlier about the research that's been done on dentists or physicians' offices and so forth. I have very often very pastoral scenes, and they know that this actually calms people. Or dentists are famous for fish, I think. Aquariums. Go in there. I think there's an aquarium in every, or bird aviaries or something. The dentist we've gone to in Wenatchee has this huge bird aviary. What? Where the fish? And they're actually. I mean, a good deal of research is, they aren't just there by accident, you know. I mean, it has a tremendous calming impact on people.
This conjured up images of a vacation when I took 3 years ago this month, where I was living on a friend's boat in a little seaport town of La Conner, Washington, and commuting every early morning up the North Cascades Highway, and one morning I decided to go all the way to Washington Pass to watch the sunrise and come back to a favorite fishing spot. I don't know if it was a holy event, but I was reading once again Scott Beck's book, The World Less Traveled, and fishing small little bird into this day, I don't know what the bird was. Started walking around in the water near me, chirping and picking up eggs that were falling off my hook and just talking to me. I was around for a good hour. And I began to finally understand parts of this book that I had for years not had a clue about. But when you started talking, it conjured up that image again for me.
I think a good illustration of a lack of wilderness is the conflict that goes on in cities. The crime rate, and you know, there really isn't a wilderness in a city. And I think that kind of says a lot there.
I think one personal insight that I had about relating your inward soul with an outward experience is just last weekend when I was alone hiking on Martin Ridge, just thinking of the solitude and of the immense space that I could see, I kind of believe that just being alone and having that expanse of wilderness which you don't get in a city, in a way gives you an ability to expand your own soul and I guess maybe make your own soul more accepting of others. Kind of expanding your own inner horizons, I guess, is just being alone and seeing such vast horizons in solitude. So I guess I really do understand what you're saying.
And in contrast, I had a little granddaughter, preschooler, come in from the backyard all excited and take me and pull me out to the back lawn. And laying on our tummies on the grass with our noses against a 1 foot square, she parted the grass and showed me how many, many things were alive.
That's amazing.
Yeah. There was a movie a number of years ago, Blue Velvet. I don't know if people have seen that, which is the opening scene begins with the camera going down into the front lawn of a nice suburban house. And it's a nice idyllic scene. And as the camera gets down into the ground, you start to see some of the stuff that is really beneath the surface, and it ends up being a tremendously violent thing that is shown, and the movie ends up being very quirky that way. And that reminds me of some of the things that I have seen out in the mountains. You know, the kind of ravages of avalanches when you go in the spring and you see these magnificent trees that have just been violently ripped at the stumps. And, you know, I know through the several summers that I've been up at Holden, there were times that I almost got a little tired of a succession of matins done by people that talk about the beautiful flowers and how wonderful and gentle nature is. Because if you look very closely at all, you see that there is another side to it as well. But that side for me has also been a very important part of my experience of the wilderness, because it's been, it has helped the wilderness always be something that is much larger than I am. And it's the sort of thing that gives me what I've called a sense of healthy humility. When I stand on the shore of Lake Superior and I look at something that is so huge, you know, it's not out to get me, but it's not there just to coddle me either. But somehow being in the presence of something that is that much larger than me, has been an important component of my experience of the wilderness.
I thought about telling a story tonight, maybe I will. One of my experiences in the Northwoods of Minnesota was getting lost. And not only was I lost, but I got a whole lot of other people lost, because I was the guide.
That was the last year that you were the guide.
Yeah, that was the last year. And what a frightening experience that was for me. I'm here today, you know, so you can see that ultimately I got unlost. And I never told the group that we were lost. But I knew we were lost. And then I went out, and so I stopped, and I went out into the woods myself to look for another lake that I thought was supposed to be where I thought it was supposed to be, and it wasn't. And then I was lost from the group. So I not only had them lost, but I was lost from the group. And I wandered around out there for a couple of hours, and by the grace of God, ended up back where the group was by some mysterious... I'd actually walked in a circle, but I thought I was walking in a straight line to this other lake. Anyway, and then reflecting on that experience, I realized, you know, how stupid that was, and how much bigger the wilderness was than I was, and how much I needed to bring my consciousness to the wilderness, or I could be destroyed by it, and I could destroy some other people by it. I think one of the things that's happening today is that because we're operating out of an unconscious relationship largely with the wilderness, and we have learned to dominate it, because we've learned how to use it for certain things to our own benefit, but now we're seeing that it's larger than we are, and in the end it will destroy us. And so our cleverness it almost goes around somehow in a circle, but our own pollution created out of our ability to use it for our own purposes is destroying us, because we have not seen it as a partner. So therefore what's going on inside me and how I'm approaching it is so terribly crucial, because I'm not going to have it anymore to help me understand what goes on inside me if I continue on the same path, or we continue on the same path.
In our journaling class, he spoke about the vastness of the wilderness as we approach it. And then as we proceed into it, we arrive into an area that, you know, shrinks in size, and we see just that which is around us. And we begin to concentrate on that which is right in front of us. And I thought of this afterwards, and relationship to this problem we are facing, it is so huge, and you know, the destruction of it. But if I myself look within just this small area where I live, and I do my best and try to change that which I touch, that somehow if each person did that, this entire problem would be solved.
Yeah. And I think that's the other message that I want to get across here, is that because of this synergy, because the microcosm and the macrocosm are related, it means then that there is something we all there is something for each of us to do. And what it is each of us has to do is the ultimate solution. And that it's a mistake to think that we can pass this problem off, that someone, you know, that our technology or our is going to solve it for us. Someone else is going to solve it for us. When in reality, if each one of us could take seriously our own inner journey and getting in touch with our own inner nature, that is, you know, I think that is one of the most important routes to solving this problem. Now, Al Pitcher and I have wonderful debates on this issue, but Al is more the outer prophet, and I guess I'm more the inner prophet. And I wouldn't want to discredit any of the necessity for those kind of massive efforts. We collectively, you know, the things that are going on today. What I'm holding out for tonight is what I call the theological and the psychological perspective on this problem. And there's also, legitimately, the scientific, economic, political problem dimension to it. But that this other side is equally as important. And it's work that only you and I can do. No one can do it for us. No one.
In fact, interestingly, we applied all of those to make the mess we made of. We used technology. We did it collectively, and therefore individually. And we used some Christian principles, like utilitarianism, to exploit gifts of creation. So it makes sense to me that we can reverse that trend by applying the same tools. And you're right that each individual making the effort then makes a societal effort, a combined effort. And we'll probably finish with all this at last session on my view of what I think is an upbeat note on the fact that I think we have the first glimmer of recognizing the problem and also the solution, and beginning to, as humankind internationally, beginning to take approach. But you're very much right. Each of us can reverse what we were all a part of. You made an interesting statement. Is out in what people call wilderness, but in wild places, and the other half in the same cities you live in, and a very high-tech part of my job, and lots of jet travel and speeches at symposiums, and the same flurry of urban life, and I live in a slightly ex-urban setting out of Portland. So my life has been a dichotomy, but it's important to me to be able to take what I learn of my inner self, and I very much relate to what you're saying, Scott, and applying it in that urban existence that I also share with all of you, and find the value, the strength that comes from that, because you're right about the child in the backyard. And if we reverse and bring the child back in ourselves, you'll find wilderness in the city. You'll find those beautiful places. Because it isn't all crime and ghettos. And some things we've done in our cities are very beautiful, and some can be very beautiful. If we apply that refocus on ourselves to where we do of necessity live. We are an urbanizing society. I don't want you to come all live in the wilderness out there. It'll be too crowded, and it won't be wilderness. So, you know, I think that's what's important here, is that we learn from nature to deal with our nature and our place in that total ecosystem. There's been a real tendency for us to be biocentric about ecology, as if we stood apart from it. And of course, if all of you, and many of you have read or listened, as you did tonight, to the words of Chief Seattle, that connectedness that Native Americans understood, and many other societies that coexist with nature today, like in Borneo, all over this world, that recognize their connectedness are very much in harmony with nature. it's only those civilized societies where we separated ourselves, lost that sight of our inner being, but also our inner responsibility to the natural world. And, you know, we need to regain that. But we don't have to de-urbanize or de-modernize society to do that. We only have to have a place to go.
Another interesting issue is that, I mean, the avalanche is also, I think, an interesting metaphor for describing what goes on psychically. Because we have our own inner avalanches. You see, the psyche, in a sense, has this terrible potential power to destroy. If its energies are not well, the way I like to put it is that I think one of the big issues today is in our world is that we have not developed what I like to call a religious ego, a value-centered consciousness. And when that doesn't happen, then powers of the psyche are unleashed and can destroy and ravage. Evil is supported by what's going on inside. Evil can have an outer reality to it, but it can't sustain itself unless it is supported by what goes on inside of people. You don't have politically oppressive systems unless that's supported by individuals who participate in political oppressive systems. And we get ourselves participating in those because we are not paying attention to what's going on. And looking inside for what God wants, and so the psyche can be a real avalanche. But one of the things that getting in touch with the wilderness and the nature helps us to do, I think, is to develop that conscious relationship. So we know where the avalanches are. If we go out in the wilderness and we don't pay it like a Holden, every soon now we'll all have avalanche training. And we know where the avalanches come down the mountains, and we have to pay attention to that. In the mining days, they even had a crossing guard out here at the avalanche chute on the western edge of town. When the children went back and forth to school, would stand there and look to, you know, to see if there was an avalanche coming. Well, we need some of those internal crossing guards. And one of the things nature can help us get in touch with, my getting lost in the wilderness made a new person out of me. I mean, I approached the wilderness quite differently from that day onward.
I think what I liked about, yeah. I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
I'm David.
David, yeah. That's right. When David talked about the avalanche and he said ravage, it really affronted me, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But then what you learned from it reassured me, because you're right. Nature is not all flowers and sunsets, and there are wonderful dynamics out there that definitely will humble us. Mount St. Helens humbled a great many people. But Mount St. Helens didn't devastate anything, and the avalanche doesn't ravage anything, and the Yellowstone fires were not a catastrophe, and there are no insect epidemics. All of those words that we, in my Mount Hood, where I was ranger once, is not a killer mountain like the Oregonian likes to cast it every time somebody dies up there, because the mountain doesn't kill people. And so we take those value-laden, emotion-charged words and assign them to wonderful natural events. And I mean full of wonder when I say wonderful. And they are very humbling, and that's why I listened and kept listening and appreciated David, that learning from nature. Because it is, it's very hard to be an atheist and spend the amount of time in the mountains that I have. It would be very hard. They are awe-inspiring. They are full of wonder. They are humbling, and they teach us lessons. A fool does not survive in the mountains. And so you learn by listening, by studying, by hearing, by respecting. And when you do that, then you also do the same for creation, because it's all the products of creation that you're observing. But I think we have to remove, when we deal with natural experiences, we have to remove all those value-laden words that we assign to them. Because it's very unfortunate, because there are no goods and bads in nature, and they tend to make fire bad and Bambi is good, and, you know, and none of that is true, not in the natural world. It all belongs.
And I think if we look at in the avalanche without us and within us, if we look at nature's beautiful balance, of which the avalanche and the landslide is a part of, you know, breaking down the mountains and whatnot to create things for us. They've led us to what we are now. But when we think of it as a balance, we need to think about the inner avalanches that occur to us, and how, as nature brings good with those things, how what seemingly destructive experiences that we have are merely part of a system that's going on that we're involved in too, which if we look at it correctly and learn from it, just becomes part of a perfect balance for us. And we have to look on unfortunate experiences as an opportunity, not as a defeat. If we look at them in that way, I don't think we should fear avalanches.
Yeah, it's the partnership, isn't it? I mean, if we can learn to respect the power, then the power can turn into creative uses. And that's true psychically. There's tremendous energy in the psyche, and if our partnership with it can be allowed to live out its creative function. But if it gets dysfunctional in the psyche, then it can turn, you see, in some really destructive ways that we all know about. And I think that's the key, right? Well, we need to quit. I didn't throw in any biblical images tonight. I was thinking about doing that, but you know, throughout Scripture there are many biblical images for our nurture too on this issue. We're all keenly aware of how often Jesus went out into the wilderness at very important times of his life and ministry to get things straight. At the very beginning, at the very end, and many places in between. We think of the whole beginnings of the people of Israel and how they went out into the wilderness, a very barren wilderness, and yet they found provision, God provided. And they came to themselves as a people in that experience of wandering, of being lost. And so there's a lot of fascinating kinds of images in Scripture that I think are very helpful. Well, we just wanted to get our creative thought processes going tonight, and our time is up. But I want to thank you for coming and sharing this time. And in a few minutes, there's going to be a snack bar in the hotel, and I don't want to keep any of you from that. So
I've got one ask for those of you that are going to participate in the retreat tomorrow. a simple one. You've heard Scott repeatedly use the word wilderness. You know the many references in Scripture that use the word wilderness. And you have used it tonight in several contexts. Think tonight, when you get a chance, or before tomorrow's first session, about what wilderness, what that phrase, what that word means to you, and what the context is and what you're using it connected with finding God in the wilderness. Because we'll be talking about that in the first session, and concepts of wilderness, and how the word makes you feel, what emotions, what feelings, what thoughts it triggers. It's when you do reflect on it, it's an almost mystical phrase for some people. I find an awful lot more meanings than I thought I had for wilderness. So do that for me.
I also remember one more thing. In thinking about the title of this retreat, we could have titled it Finding God in the Wilderness, or we could have entitled it Finding God in You in the Wilderness. And maybe they're both the same thing. Okay, there's a few more of these if anybody wants to kind of have a schedule of what's going to be happening these days. One addition is that on Sunday afternoon from 1 to 3, David's going to have the pot shop. David's our artist in residence here in the community, and he will have the pot shop open for us. For anybody that would like to try to get their hands in a piece of clay and maybe express some of the things that have been moving in them over the last couple days, so, or anything else you'd like to try down there.